This program has been brought to you by Roberta's Pizza. Roberta'sPizza.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Eating Disorder. I'm Paul Gerard. Please welcome my co-host, Mr. Crazy Legs Conti.
Honored to be here.
And the Reverend Spiro.
Whoop, whoop.
Crazy Legs actually has Crazy Legs written on his license.
That's true.
I asked him today what his given name is, and he said Crazy Legs, and he whipped out his license and showed me it actually says Crazy Legs on the license.
Yes. He whipped out his license.
Well, that's my belt buckle unhooked at the same moment, and my pants fell down. So
I can't wait. Well, Christmas is coming up. Christmas is coming up. I can pull out my mistletoe belt buckle.
Oh, that's a good,
always a good time.
Don't put it down. Don't put it on upside down, otherwise you're going to get a lot of belly button lint in your female admirer's teeth.
It's no fun that way. How was your weekend, fellas? You have a good time?
Yeah, I did the Jackson Heights Halloween parade, which is all kids and parents. There were no sexy potatoes. There were no, you know, slutty, what do you call it, cowboys. It was just...
I love the slutty cowboys.
Wow.
I'm glad that you were looking for the slutty cowboys.
Well, sexy potatoes, that wasn't enough for you?
What exactly is the sexy potato?
It's just...
Lots of eyes on it.
We saw a sexy Mrs. Potato Head.
Mrs. Potato Head.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
A couple of years ago.
I'm still obsessed with it. Got it.
And what did you go as, Spiro?
I went as a dude hanging out and watching that and going for some Thai food afterwards.
You didn't get dressed up?
No. I did for when we had the Donnie Vomit show, me and him did that thing last time.
He did that thing.
I did the Joker, but it didn't really work out that well.
Well, it seems like you should have been dressed as... like Mr. Potato Head, looking for your long lost missus. But
well, you know,
I was in the greatest Halloween spot on earth. I was on Frenchman Street in New Orleans.
Woo.
For Danielle Franco and Rick, last name that Danielle will be taking, and their wedding. It was amazing. And there was a second line to the bar afterwards. But I will say that there was and as you know, chef from New Orleans, the second line is for celebration, but it can be celebration of a funeral. It can
Absolutely.
Be in sadness, tragedy, joy, celebration. And it was interesting doing the second line.
Which kind of makes sense for a wedding.
Yes.
Because you just don't know which way it's going to go.
Well, everywhere we went, I was watching the...
could be bliss or death.
Everywhere we went, I was watching the Saints game at the Rusty Nail, and a guy came up to me. He's like, Crazy Legs, you're not going to remember who I am, but... you got out of this minivan with these two hot chicks, and I was like, oh, my God, you're Crazy Legs Conti. I was like, I do remember that night. He's like, you do? I'm like, yeah, that ended my 8-year relationship with the woman I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. So thank you for recognizing my pseudo-celebrity and convincing the two women that I should be worthy of doing things that I shouldn't have been doing. So
Very
he was
nice.
Like, that's awesome, man. I was like, I don't know.
Guys, I want to throw this out there.
Yes,
I mean,
please do.
Yeah, we want to throw a shout-out to Tom Magliozzi. Now, you may not know who that is, but that's the guy who was one of the co-hosts of Car Talk. When we first started this show, we said we wanted to be kind of like Car Talk on NPR, except we wanted, you know, cursing and food and porn.
You seem to remember that conversation very well. I don't think I was there for that.
Nah, dude, come on.
It was never really my aspiration of growing up to be like
Car Talk. No, but he was a great radio host. He did a great show. I don't even give a shit about cars, and I'd listen to his show.
That's true. And my mom actually gets her cars repaired at that garage in Cambridge. She says they're just like they are, or they were, on air and off air. So
you should always you always have to ask somebody before you go to a mechanic, which is actually a perfect segue for bringing on our guest. He's a buddy of mine, and we always say that when we're doing consulting on restaurants and things that we should write a book called I Got a Guy. Mm-hmm. Because anything that comes up, you know, like, hey, we need an electrician. I got a guy. You know, we need somebody to fix a refrigerator. I got a guy.
It's that or
you
I know a guy.
Guest tonight. I got a guy.
I got a guy. So please let us welcome Gerard Rennie. Gerard, how you doing?
I'm good, baby. Thank you.
Welcome.
Very nice. I've been wanting to get Gerard on the show for a while now. He's had quite a life. He was born. It's the first subtitle in Goodfellas that says East New York, 1959.
Mm-hmm.
That's when Gerard was born and where he's from. He's He really knows old New York, new New York. Got a lot of stories to tell.
Made me cry.
It made you cry when you saw that?
When I saw that, I was like, holy shit, how'd that happen?
Oh, nice.
East New York is quite a different place then, huh?
When they did that scene, it was like the garage, the back of the truck opened, and they were handing out cartons of illegal cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
It's what my father used to do. He used to drive the cigarettes up from the Carolinas without the stamps, and then I used to take them around the neighborhood.
And now they're doing it again.
They're doing it again.
Well, yeah. Not to get too personal,
considering we have to pay $14 for a freaking back.
On that route, I know that Henry Hill would stop in Baltimore on the block, and he was never worried that the truck would get stolen as he frequented the gentleman's club. So I don't know. Would you have known your father's route there? Did he ever talk about the Baltimore?
I think my father was a little older than Henry Hill.
All right, fair enough. Yeah. No, the block was probably still there.
Your family was in the restaurant business, yeah?
Yeah, we had a restaurant right on Dean Street and Stone Avenue, which is now Mother Gaston Boulevard. I don't know who Mother Gaston is. I have no idea who she is, but I'm sure she deserves a street named after her. And yeah, since the 30s, they had a restaurant till the early 70s when they moved out of the neighborhood. Hmm. But yeah, it was called Peps.
Peps.
And then we later on opened the restaurant called Z Peps.
Right, right, right.
But yeah, no, it was, and that's was my, and my mother's father also had a restaurant right by Kennedy Airport.
What kind of crowd frequented Peps?
Peps was mostly a neighborhood crowd, but my uncle, who was the son of Pep, got into politics, and you know the story about him. Was Meat Esposito and became the boss of the Democratic Party in Brooklyn.
So they called him the Kingmaker, right?
They called him Chief Boss, but you know the Kingmaker was more, it was because that position he had, he was allowed to appoint judgeships, which. That's pretty important. That's pretty good.
that holds some water right there. You got some sand going on right there.
Then later the place became, the restaurant became where he would hold court. So all throughout the 60s, he would basically, he would have his meetings there on Sunday. Mayor Lindsay visited there. Nelson Rockefeller. You know, everybody came out to eat his mother's meatballs. So
wow.
So it was, it was a wacky time being a kid that, basically East New York was back then is still a ghetto, except it was, was mostly that little area was just all Italian.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, at this point, New Orleans Avenue is actually developing. I mean, it's getting to the point where like East New York, for our listeners, our one listener, who doesn't know this, East New York is way the fuck out there.
Right. Now they call it East Williamsburg.
No, but the truth is, it's developing. It's becoming a very family neighborhood.
Of course it is. It's like Mark Twain said, they keep making people, but they stop making land.
Yeah. No, but it's becoming a very family neighborhood. It's actually, the property values are getting much higher. It's becoming a someplace where people are investing from the standpoint, not so much of the hipster fucking condo thing, but where they see that there's a lot of buildings that actually are not going to be torn down because they're pre-war, right? And they're actually, it's not a bad place to raise a family at this point.
It's still pretty rough heading out there.
It is.
I mean, I can't. Like, my son just got married and lives right off of Fulton Street in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When we were kids, we weren't allowed to go into Bedford-Stuyvesant. Now you can't go into East New York. So yeah. What's happened to Brooklyn is how it's evolved. It's amazing to me.
So you were saying you were telling me when you were growing up, with the Gaudis. I mean,
well, that's where they all came. Fat Andy, John Gotti. I mean, they all came from that neighborhood. That's where my brothers were friends with them. They used to come to my house when they were kids. It was a very tight knit community. But that's where they all grew up.
So how did you wind up getting out of that neighborhood and that lifestyle? I'm sure, it was pretty romantic to a kid growing up, just like in the beginning of Goodfellas, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. How did you wind up not going in that route?
Well, you were talking earlier, and everybody started moving out of that neighborhood in like the late 60s. We left in the early 70s. We moved out to Long Island. But then, you know, my mother died when I was just a teenager. And I wound up moving back into Ozone Park, which was basically like an extension of East New York.
Right.
Because most people, you know, some went to Long Island, but most people from East New York, most of the Italians, moved to Howard Beach and Ozone Park. And so all those guys that you were mentioning, basically that was their neighborhood. So I was finishing high school, but basically pretty much hanging around, you know, that crowd again. Going to the racetrack on a regular basis. And so my uncle was not happy with what was going on. My brother, Joseph, was living and working in Long Island for him, but wanted to be an actor and wanted to move into the city. And so one day my uncle, called me to where he moved his Sunday meetings, was the house he built in Canarsie for his mom. Hmm. And he says, what are you going to do with yourself? You're about to finish high school. And I told him he was the godfather of a guy named Freddie Giovanelli, who was at the time a pretty well-known guy. And I said, well, why don't you just, get me with Freddie and I'll be around him. And he cracked me in the fucking face. So he said, I got a better idea. He said, nobody's been from our family is in the restaurant business anymore. Why don't you go in the restaurant business? I said, Jesus, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
What's the big? Right?
Little did he know.
So, and that was the start of it.
So he just, instead of just getting one quick in the back of the head, he put in a life of slow torture. Right.
Still, I'm still dying a slow death.
So that's pretty amazing. So then you were saying you worked at Studio 54 back in the heyday.
Well, again, mm-hmm. Mead being Mead, and being the guy that he was.
It's pretty good to have an uncle who was the borough president.
He was, he wasn't the borough president. That would have been, that would have been too easy. He was actually, he was the Brooklyn Democratic boss. It wasn't even an elected position.
And that way he doesn't have anybody telling him what to do.
Right,
yeah.
He didn't get paid for it.
Right.
It was an unpaid position.
Oh, okay.
So,
How do you make his money?
They send the ribbons to the office.
He went into two smartest businesses. He went into the printing business and he went into the insurance business. Because everybody he knew needed to have printing done and needed insurance.
He'd be like, hey, Frankie, you should get a policy today.
Yeah, let me print it up.
Right.
On a bigger scale, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So you guys connected the dots. I was like, do a lot of printing presses blow up that they need insurance?
I was in high school. I was in high school. I used to, because he had the account for the account. He did all the printing for the PBA. So in high school, I had the PBA card that said Mayor's Office.
What's PBA? Is that a microbrewery from East New York?
Exactly.
So, for those who don't know, it's Police Benevolence Association.
So Studio 54.
Which doesn't really exist, quote unquote.
What was your position there?
Well, I basically was a bouncer. But
I saw some pictures. You were a pretty bouncer.
I was a very pretty bouncer.
Yeah, you must have done well over there.
At the time, I was about 149 pounds. So it was not a big threat.
But it's Studio 54. I mean, how?
Well, they say that the story I read was that Alec Baldwin was one of the shirtless barbacks.
Really?
And he saw so much sex that he had to quit. It freaked him out because it made him too libidinous.
Really?
Yeah. Pussy.
Did you know him from back then?
No, I didn't know him from back then, but what does that say about me? Because it didn't bother me at all.
So how'd you get the
job?
And
what does libidinous mean?
Well, you corrected all the Italian words I used, so I figured I'd go waspy American on you.
How'd you get the position?
Mead got them their license.
He got them their liquor license.
Roy Cohn was their lawyer. Everybody knows who Roy Cohn is.
Yeah, yeah.
And Roy Cohn was one of Mead's buddies. I don't know if you want to call him a buddy,
right?
But
associate.
They couldn't colleague. get a liquor license. 6 months they were running down every day trying to get catering licenses because you could do that at the time. And finally, he got them the liquor license. He went to my brother Joseph. He got my brother Joseph the job there first. Got me into the restaurant business, and then after 3 or 4 months of working in a restaurant and then going and hanging out at Studio after night, I said, what the fuck am I doing in the restaurant business? I said, I want to be here too.
Yeah.
So then all of a sudden, they created a position for me.
Huh,
nice. Skinny, coaxing, snorting bouncer.
That's good. You actually got paid for that.
Yeah. Thank you.
That must have been so wild. I mean, every time I talk to you and Peter, another mutual friend of ours, we were born a decade late, Spiro. Because, you know, by the time we were 18, 19, you know, we had AIDS and all this other stuff that we had to deal with. We
missed all this wild shit. I still resent all that shit. I'm like, thank you, 70s. Go fuck yourselves, well, you know?
they say that it made the Generation X the hardest working and most adaptable generation out of all of them.
But we still didn't have the
But we didn't have the fun, you know?
Yeah,
so I go, great, I'm fucking adaptable.
We had VHS.
We had VHS.
Yeah.
But that must have been wild working at Studio 54 at that age.
It was, you know, the fun part was that, you know, whether you were a busboy, the dishwasher, the bartender, you went around town and everybody treated you like a celebrity. You went to restaurants, you paid for nothing. You went to bars, you paid for nothing. You went to clothing stores, everybody wanted you to wear their clothes.
Huh.
Wow.
So it was incredible. Nobody will ever see anything like it again.
So you were there with your brother Joseph. Tell us a little bit about Joseph.
Joseph was, he was my best friend. And, you know, touching on AIDS, he died about 20-something years ago of AIDS. So the stories that we all tell and we all like to hear about Studio 54, they're all very bittersweet because, you know, we lost not only him, we lost a lot of guys. We lost a lot of people. We lost a lot of creative people. From that era, but he was 10 years older than me. He was the first, you know, he came into the city. I moved in with him. You know, I never forget the conversation when he told me he was gay. It was like, you know, we were having a conversation about drugs, you know, because I was just fresh out of high school. I was 18 years old. So he's like, you know, sometimes I dabble in, you know, I do some cocaine and everything. And I was like, he was my older brother. So it was like, eh, fuck that. So what? And I was like, you know, and I'm gay. I was like, okay.
It didn't shock you.
It didn't.
So the guys in the neighborhood, nobody knew.
No, because it wasn't. First of all, he didn't act like it, and at a point there wasn't. It was more. I think that it started out where he was kind of bisexual, so he dated girls, he dated guys. It didn't really at that point, and we were so far removed from the neighborhood at that point. It really didn't. It wasn't like anybody was really going to know until they started coming in and saying that they wanted, you know. And they used to come into the Studio 54 with the Roy Cohen letter because that was the only way they could get in. Hmm. So,
letter? What do you mean?
If you were one of Roy's clients, which a lot of wise guys were, you know, and they wanted to go to Studio 54, they would come to the front door
so
with
a
handwritten letter from Roy Cohen. So it was like, and anybody who had that letter, you knew, you know, they wouldn't be able to walk up to the ropes and get in on their own. So they had to come with that letter.
Wow.
Dear Joey, please let Frankie and Vinny in tonight.
Yes.
They are swell fellas. So, all right, so we're going to take a quick break for station identification, and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about Studio 54, and then we'll talk about the restaurant business, which eventually probably brings you back into the gangsters. We'll be right back, folks.
You are listening to Dirty Hands by Eula.
Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage. This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Eating Disorder. With our guest Gerard Rennie, he's taking us through a little bit of the New York City past. So we were on Studio 54 talking about that. Your Uncle Mead got him their liquor license. Pretty wild place to be. So then, what happened after that? How did you wind up going into the restaurant business?
Well, it was from the smack in the face. It was always the journey I was going to go on. School wasn't for me, like a lot of us, and
pretty much everybody in this room.
Right, exactly. So, and the restaurant business is a business for misfits. So, I fit right in.
I always say that the kitchens of New York welcomed me with open track marked arms.
I was a shorter to cook, but I would like to point out my SAT scores were very high for a shorter cook.
We're all pretty bright.
Yeah, I mean, we really are. I mean, I did well in school. I just didn't like the authority.
Right.
You know, but for some reason, I was okay with chefs throwing fucking pans at my head. It was like being home.
Right. Exactly. You know? So that's it's all part of it. So the screaming, the yelling, that's the way I so I fit right in.
Absolutely.
Anyways, I just it was after studio, I bounced around some more clubs, bartending, working the door. I mean, I ran the door at Crisco Disco.
Crisco Disco.
No, none of you guys remember
no.
Crisco
no,
Disco.
I don't remember.
No,
Crisco
I wish
Disco.
I okay. did though.
Chris, all right, you wanted that. Crisco Disco was a gay after hours club.
Oh,
how appropriate! Okay.
Well, in the Meatpacking District.
Okay.
Oh,
and the guy, the owner Hank, used to hang out at studio, and what happened was, it became like the after studio. Because Steven started hanging out there, and basically it was like a sleazy mm-hmm. after-hours gay club. And the DJ booth was a Crisco can. Hank says to me, why don't you come work for me? I'm building a VIP room. So now what was happening is everybody was hanging out downstairs, but Hank had the whole loft building. He lived in it. He had floors above. It was his, he had the whole building with the interior elevated. He could drive a car into. So now he's building, and I was pretty good looking.
Yeah, you were pretty good looking.
Thank you. Keep saying that.
I was a lot
fucking thinner too. But so he's like, well, why don't you, you can work the bar up in the VIP room. It's only going to be the people, from here. So I was like, okay. So he builds a VIP room. But he's like, it got delayed. So he has me working the door. So part of my job was you had to frisk everybody coming.
I used to have that job, too. I used to do it at the Pyramid. And the one thing I learned is don't go into the boots. Because it was always either a knife or a freaking syringe.
You used to work at the Hellfire Club, too, didn't you?
I did that, too, yeah. Oh. That was the best. That was the best job ever.
He just stood outside
I was not allowed to laugh. That was the one rule at the Hellfire Club. You're not allowed to laugh, right? And so literally, I spent the whole night going.
That place creeped me the fuck out. That was just a creepy place, man. You walk in there, you just wanted to shower. Not there, somewhere else.
Our friend Jimmy Pravacilis, right, they used to put peanuts out, right, at the Hellfire Club. And my band actually got they asked us to play. We're like, great. And Jimmy's fucking starving. And he grabs a fistful of peanuts, and I slap his hand down. And he goes, what the fuck are you doing? I'm like, remember where you fucking are.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
My buddy Iggy loved the potato chips there, though.
That's like eating the buffet at Billy's Topless.
Yeah, I don't want to get too off track, but they met a guy.
We're Tops and Topless. You remember their cards?
Yeah.
We're Tops and Topless.
Yep.
I love that place.
They had a fried chicken buffet at 8:30 on Tuesdays, and I had a basketball game at 8:30 on Tuesdays. So Pete Connell and I would like stand by the kitchen door waiting for the chicken and then run over to the church.
You
where
would actually
basketball.
Eat it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I did draw the line at the potato chips at the vault or the Hellfire Club. Yeah. But, yeah,
at least
but,
we have limits.
Right.
So then, so you were working there. You were working the door, frisking people.
Sometimes two or three times
bucks.
A night. Yeah,
everybody was very happy.
Yeah,
including me.
So back then, I always hear stories about back then. You could, if you were starting a restaurant, you could go to a linen company and you're going to bankroll me. We'll use your company.
Listen, back then, the meat guy, the fish guy, everybody would kick in because they were buying your account.
Wow.
Le Cirque started that way.
Wow.
It cost to open a restaurant then? How much did it cost to open your first restaurant?
My first restaurant was a huge place. It was at the South Street Seaport. So it was all union. It cost about $2 million. But they gave us half of the money. And then we raised the rest
unions.
Of it. The union. Wow. It was fine. They would rob the tile from your job and then sell it back to you.
That doesn't happen anymore. Now, how about smaller places? Like you were in Soho for a while, like when Soho was still just a total wasteland.
Yeah, that was before
Montrachet and before all that stuff, huh?
No, Odeon had just opened down in Tribeca. It was it was the early 80s. Mm-hmm. So Odeon opened in this was Central Falls, which opened in 1979. It was right on West Broadway. And I got there probably in 81, 82. And, but yeah, it was, it was just starting to happen, but that was basically just West Broadway, mm-hmm. And I mean, the Odeon was really a pioneer back then.
Yeah.
Yeah. For people who don't know, basically it was Studio 54, but in restaurant form. In what essence, in that it was a party, but it was food and it was
right. Well, the way it wound up turning, and the fact that it's still going strong.
Yeah, well, he had to feed that for five years before he started turning a profit.
Yeah, but
I'm
it was
sure
also,
he did.
It was
yeah.
also like Studio 54, but it was also CB's too. I mean, CBGB's fed into Odeon at the same time. Like all those people used to go eat there too.
Didi Ramone loved the tartar.
I still love the fries at Odeon. Were the best.
The Mud Club too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the Mud Club. Yeah, exactly.
And what was the restaurant that you opened there?
Well, I was I was a GM at Central Falls.
Okay, oh, cool.
So which was way ahead of its time. It was a restaurant bar, and it had and in it was a functioning gallery with a curator. So we would change the shows, every 5-6 weeks.
Wow. I always love the stories. We have a mutual friend, this guy, Peter Herrero, who owned a place called Cafe Central up on, 79th in Amsterdam?
75th in Amsterdam.
75th in Amsterdam. But he had, John Goodman was one of his bartenders. Bruce Willis was a bartender.
Goodman was his maitre d'.
Oh, the maitre d'.
Bruce Willis was his bartender. Oh. But Bruno was his nickname.
I love Bruno.
Yeah, that was his nickname.
I love the stories about the people that you would have hanging out there. You could walk in. He said, you'd walk in, you'd see Andy Warhol at a table, and then Cher would be at another table, and John Gotti would be at another table, and some Hell's Angels would be at another table.
Yeah, Cafe Central was where everybody hung out before they went to Studio 54. Right. Mm-hmm. They were just, De Niro. That was their, neighborhood place. And that place was a pioneer because, 79th Street, I lived on 85th between West End and Riverside. And basically back in the late 70s, between Broadway and Columbus was a wasteland.
Right. So it was a tough neighborhood. Yeah.
And for him to open up on Amsterdam Avenue back then, it was... Columbus was just starting.
I don't want to get too late. I want to talk about your book. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
The book that's actually a book, or that's an idea everybody loves.
We'll talk about the first book, the book that's actually published.
The Men of the Pacific Street Social Club.
Yeah.
It came about, when I was in. I had a restaurant called Lucky's Bar and Grill in the mid '90s. And one of the older gentleman from East New York passed away, and we all went back, you know, to the neighborhood. He actually was the he owned the funeral parlor in the neighborhood, right across the street from the church on Pacific Street. And so we, you know, everybody was there. Everybody came to pay their respects. He was such a, you know, he was a very, he's Stanley Molinari. He was a, you know, real good friend of my family, very one of my father's best friends. And so what happened was it came, you know, the guys started talking about the old social club that was basically right across the street on Pacific Street where we went to, right next to where we went to school.
Whose was that?
That was, it was Nicky Carraza's club back in, you know, but back in the day.
Because there's also... I was thinking of the one on President Street. That was the gallows, right?
Yeah, that had nothing to do with East New York.
Yeah, nothing to do with East New York. You know what's interesting? I don't want to cut you off, but Joey Gallo, when he had that big fight when he was at war with Carmine Persico or something.
I think it was the Colombo family that was really
right
when
He started hanging out. He started hanging out in the village, and he was like hanging out with Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan actually wrote a song about him, Joey. But when he went to the mattresses, for you people out there that don't know what that is, it's when you go into hiding and they just throw a bunch of mattresses in an empty room and the whole crew hides out. That's where IKEA is now.
And there are mattresses.
They're selling those mattresses now.
Right. You wouldn't even be able to tell because the names are so confusing.
I know,
so
exactly.
now it's called going to the Kerplunkses.
Yeah, umlauts and you know.
But you know what though, the meatballs not as good as they used to be when the Italians.
No, exactly. Yeah. All right. So
who was the actor he was with when he got killed? What's the guy?
Jerry Orbach.
Jerry Orbach.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Right.
Yeah, Jerry Orbach.
God. He was Briscoe.
And Umberto's.
Right. Umberto's, yeah.
Briscoe,
yeah.
Man.
One of the 19 locations Umberto's has existed. Every time
a
mob hit happened and the business went up, then they moved to another location.
Wait, I'm sorry. What did you just say?
Well, they are the originator of, like, business would be declining and then a hit would happen and then everybody wanted that table and then it would die down again and they'd move locations hoping to get like
somebody get shot.
They had a much different business plan. They were like,
yes.
Yeah.
I remember Sparks. Remember they kept the body outline outside for years.
Oh yeah,
they actually painted it. They painted it right outside.
Yeah, it's great for business. So the Pacific Street Social Club. So
basically what happened was these guys had an idea. Well, why don't we take over the club and let's come back to the neighborhood and still, like, you know, like the old days, come back. So they basically took over the old club that the funny, you know, Rocco DiSpirito's father owns the building.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I don't think he still does, but he owned the building. And I remember, you know, so every Thursday we would meet there, play cards, and then we'd take turns cooking. And I had the restaurant on 57th and 6th, and one of my a friend that was an editor up at Hearst magazine, I said to her, I said, you know, Nancy, I said, this, you know, I have an idea for a book. I said, you know, we go to the club, you know, we play cards, but then everybody takes turns cooking and cooks old family recipes and everything else. She says, you know, that sounds like a pretty good idea. Within 2 months, I had a book contract, a $40,000 retainer, and that was it.
Very nice.
And it basically came out to be I collected up recipes, I collected up photographs and stories, and it's called the Men of the Pacific Street Social Club Cook Italian, and was one of my favorite things I've ever done. I would have done it for free.
We can get it at Barnes & Noble, or we can get it at
Amazon is still available. Amazon's still available. All right, it came out in 1999.
Excellent.
Cool. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about, we don't have a whole hell of a lot of time, but I really want to talk about the new book that you've been working on. You sent me some excerpts from it.
The Four Horsemen.
It completely, just really grabbed my attention. It was amazing.
Growing up in East New York, it was just, you know, it was in the 60s. East New York was just, you know, it was like a powder keg. It's where all the race riots happened. It's, you know, it really was tense constantly. And then a lot of the kids that my brother grew up with, they wound up becoming junkies. And the story follows four kids, you know, that grew up in that neighborhood that all, you know, wound up becoming junkies, then trying to become, you know, and telling individual stories, and then evolving into their life, trying to become functioning adults, and then all four of them wind up dying of AIDS, which is exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And so it just, you know, unfortunately, I'm sorry, it doesn't have a happy ending, but...
But so, it really was amazing. The pieces that you sent me
right,
were fantastic.
Just, you know, the things that took place, you know, because, you know, them being, you know, having grown up and then having other guys that were making their bones and trying to become wise guys, and the clash of that where, like, you know, you and I were friends and, you know, went to Catholic school together.
Yeah, but
and
you
then you're a junkie and now I'm,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And the fact that you're an Italian American and I'm looking at you now like you're a stain on our neighborhood and on our heritage, and the things that, you know, took place. I was telling you in the cab about the story of who actually one of the guys was a they called him Beep. His name was Junior, and he was actually my mother's cousin, and he lived across the street from us with his mother, who was a widow. And we were visiting my mother's sister, who actually lived in that building as well. And I was about 8 years old, and I remember leaving the apartment, and we're walking down the stairs. And Beep was in the coming into the entryway of the building, and he was beaten to shit, bloody, stoned off out of his mind, and totally naked. The guys, you know, from our neighborhood had caught them all up on Pacific Street and gave them to send a message to them and teach them a lesson. They thought they were teaching them a lesson. Which is ignorant in itself.
Yeah, because a junkie's never going to do junk again because you beat him.
I beat him, and I just, you know, and being 8 years old and seeing this with my mom, and, like, you know, every time I tell the story, I want to cry, and her seeing her cousin's son, who was basically our blood, she's like, we're walking down the stairs, and she grabs, the only thing she could think about doing was grabbing the doormat from the apartment that was there and wrapping it around his waist, and helping him up to his back to his mother's. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, and that's the that story stayed with me, you know, this whole time. And it's really the idea of, you know, of how I wanted to tell this, you know, this tale and follow these four guys from when they were young kids in Catholic school, and how they took this turn, and then how their lives intertwined after that.
It was amazing. All the excerpts you sent, it left me just wanting more.
Cool.
Everything
I
read.
I just got a little misty listening to it, I swear to God.
All right, so just to change gears a little bit.
Can we finish on a positive note, please?
I don't know if this is necessarily going to be a positive note, but it might develop a couple of laughs. I heard you went to a restaurant recently, which has become very famous in New York, and I don't want to badmouth anybody, so let's call it the Schmeatball Schmop.
Schmeatball Schmop.
Yeah.
Right. The Schmeatball Schmop.
They sell Schmeatballs.
They do.
All right.
Sweaty balls.
Yeah. what was your take on that? Because every time, go ahead. Let's hear it. What do you got?
Well. I, you know what? I'm gonna talk about myself again.
Yeah, let's keep it in
because,
the eye.
Because, you know, I'm a guy who I have an Italian cookbook, okay, and I can make a meatball or two.
I actually
have a fucking trophy.
Didn't you
okay?
win the best meatball in New York one year?
No. I won the Brooklyn Meatball Slapdown in 2011, my friend.
Oh, okay. Hey, there you go.
Okay. And the next year, I got to go back to judge, and the meatball shop. Oh shit.
Oh,
the Schmeatball Shop, slop.
Yeah.
Sorry. Was actually competed. They finished 5 out of 6. They finished, and number 6 got disqualified because they actually made a sausage sandwich.
But, you know, the thing that always gets me about that, and I mean, they're doing fantastic, and wherever they are, they're fucking...
You got to admire them, man.
They don't give a shit about what the fuck I'm saying. You know, they're laughing all the way
right.
to the bank.
Pork cupcakes.
But, yeah, pork.
Right now, they're at home saying, you know what, take their trophy and shove it up your ass.
And we don't deliver, fuck you.
Okay? But I think the thing that's interesting about it is, you know, from growing up in Brooklyn, that if anybody would have gone there if they had opened up in the 80s. Everybody would have been like, what are you fucking kidding me? I think most of the people that are in New York now
are from
New
York. That's why you said it. When you said it, that was the perfect analogy of this, that most people who were eating those meatballs, most people from the city aren't from the city anymore. Nah. We wouldn't, you know, we look at that and say, what the fuck is this? Mm-hmm. You know, and but that's the truth. And you know, now they're on they go on the Tonight Show.
They got a deal to do a sitcom on CBS.
God bless them.
A sitcom.
Based on their
interactions.
Really?
So let's just wrap it up with this. I mean, if you can, in just a, you know, a nutshell, like what's the difference in from when you started in the restaurant business in New York in comparison to now? I mean, aside from the outrageous rents, and
that's the story. I mean, you see, you know, the margins are so small now, and the risk is so large.
Wow.
It's we were talking about the Cafe Central and Peter. His rent was $900 a month.
Jesus.
Okay.
Wow. And it was all cash.
And he was doing he was doing $35,000 a week with a $900 a month rent.
Jesus.
And cash.
Yeah,
so, he doesn't
the IRS
work,
you know, wasn't up your fucking ass because it wasn't all electronic.
Yeah, now it's impossible. Everybody now is looking to get a piece of that dollar. The credit card company, you know, Groupon. Everybody wants to come to a deal to figure out how they're going to take a piece of a dollar that's already stretched to $1.50.
And our lovely friends that we want to, you know, throw a dick in their face, Yelp.
Yeah. So, you know, not unlike being a gangster, everybody knows the rules of the game and people still get into it. People are still getting into the restaurant business, even though that we know it's, you know, an atrocious business to be in. It's very difficult to actually make a buck. If you could give anybody advice after all your years in this business and everything you've seen, what would you tell somebody today who's going into the restaurant business?
Don't go in the restaurant business.
you're saying take the whack in the face instead, huh?
Yeah, take the whack. If you could do it all over, would you have joined Frankie's crew?
I'd be with Freddie right now.
In the dirt nap. The dirt nap would have been better off. Well, thank you so much, Gerard. We really appreciate you coming down tonight. Anybody who's out there wanting to publish this book, it's fantastic. The excerpts are great, and I really hope that somebody picks it up because
I
want to read more.
Where do people try to get a hold of you? And I mean, like, not the frisking outside the Frisco Disco, but social media.
I have a website for my restaurant consulting company, PacificStreetHospitality.com, so they could just get me there.
Look it up.
Very nice. Thanks again for coming down. And
this was a blast.
Everybody out there in Radio Land, have a good night.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.